Hello and welcome to our Practice Building Success System coaching call, or actually presentation call. And I'm really, really excited about today. And this is I'm going to read you his bio, but the talk we have today is on niching. And they know that that's a topic that we as holistic practitioners tend to have a love-hate relationship with. And our guest, Ted Hargrave, will address that because he understands where we're coming from with that. Of course, we as holistic practitioners think that we don't need a niche. We can treat everybody. So why should we limit who we're going to treat? So let me tell you a little bit about Ted, and then we'll go ahead and get started. So first, I'm just going to read you his official bio, and then I'll tell you a little bit about how I know Ted. The name of our talk today is The Niching Spiral, and Ted Hargrave is a hippie who developed a knack for marketing and then learned how to be a hippie again. Despite years in the nonprofit and activist world, finally had to admit he was a marketing nerd, and in the end, he became a marketing coach for, guess what, hippies. Maybe it was because he couldn't stand seeing his hippie friends struggle to promote their amazing green and holistic projects. Sound familiar? Maybe it was because he couldn't keep a 9-to-5 job to save his life. That sounds familiar too. Whatever the reason, for almost a decade, he's been touring his marketing workshops around Canada, bringing refreshing and definitely unorthodox ideas to conscious entrepreneurs and green businesses that help them to grow and the businesses to thrive without selling their souls. So he's offered, this is really cool, and we want to find out more about this. He's offered most of his workshops on a modified pay-what-you-can basis, a small deposit to attend, and then people choose the amount they want to pay at the end. This feels like a minor miracle, as Chad spent his early marketing days learning and applying some very inauthentic, high-pressure, extremely gross and pushy marketing approaches, the kind of stuff that we don't really like. This has made him super allergic to these kinds of approaches because he discovered that they made him feel slimy, even in personal relationships. Couldn't sleep well, and he's very sorry to all those people he spoke with back in the day. So after a decade of unlearning and unpacking that whole scene, he now feels ready and able to help other people find ways to market and to feel wonderful. And before I get Ted on to talk to us today, a couple more things I want to say. One is, if you're on the web, you can see over on the left-hand side, you'll see a link to Ted's website and also a free gift that he has, and we'll talk more about that later. And if you're not on the web, just marketingforhippies.com is a great place to find Ted. I first met Ted, it must be 5 years ago, right? I think it was about 5 years ago at a networking event that Jesse and Sharla of Now Thrive Academy, used to be Rejuvenate, put on. And it was just a small group of us, maybe 15, 18 of us, sitting around in a circle in a really beautiful place nestled in the woods near Santa Cruz, California. And I was like, marketing for hippies? Like, really? It intrigued me. And as I got to know Ted a little bit and ran into him at other events, I could see that approach was an awesome approach for us in this holistic, touchy-feely kind of environment. And we all, like, people say to me, oh, I did this great presentation, but I was afraid to make an offer at the end because it made me feel icky, or things like that. I had this nice conversation with somebody and I gave them all this great advice, but then I felt bad about asking them to pay me money. So Ted is awesome at really getting that and understanding that, having been in that situation himself and been able to maneuver and navigate the waters and learn how to actually make a living doing this, because that's the only way we can actually be available to all these people we want to serve, is if we can get the money in from it and do it in a way that doesn't feel icky. So today's topic, the niching spiral, it's one that's near and dear to my heart because I fought and fought and fought against niching. And even though I probably have a niche now, it's probably a cheating niche because it's not really that niched. So anyway, I want to just let Ted take over and just share with us all these, that you have a 7-step system, I know, that we would love to learn about to make it easy for people to figure out who they best serve and why it's important to do that. So take it away, Ted. Thank you.
Sure. Well, hello, everybody. So I guess before I begin, I should unpack that a little bit. I wouldn't call what I've got a system as in a kind of a guaranteed approach to anything. But I would say there's an approach, or there's a manner of approaching this that I found takes a lot of the stress out of it and does seem to have it happen a little, maybe a little faster, a little more gently, and maybe more in a more true way. Yeah, so maybe that's good enough to start. But now you opened up with wrestled with this yourself. I'm curious what it was for you when you were first encountering this niche thing. What was the resistance for you?
For me, it was, well, but what about those people who aren't depressed, if that's where I went? Or what about those people over there that don't have hormone imbalances, but I can certainly help them have more energy, or I can help them with their digestion? Or like, it's, I was trained as a holistic practitioner, and I look at everything, and I can bring it all down to a system, and I, you know, pretty much can help anybody that comes along. And so it was like, I felt like if I was to niche, then I'm excluding a lot of people.
So there's this, I think there's a lot of places where the whole conversation around niche could use some reevaluation, and maybe there's some places that people get stuck. One of the places that I see we get stuck is niche has become, in Canada we pronounce it niche, in the States you pronounce it niche. But you know, you guys can't be perfect.
Yeah, tomato and tomato and all that kind of stuff, right?
it's become synonymous with target market.
Mm.
Yeah, so niche has become synonymous with who we're trying to reach. And so then when somebody can't figure out one single target market, they're just kind of beating themselves up of like, oh, I guess I don't have a really clear niche at all. But it's good to sort of maybe take a look at that again, because niche, it comes from, the etymology of it is, comes from the old French verb nicher, which means to make a nest. And so when we're niching, this is kind of what we're doing. We're making a nest. We're making a little place for ourselves in the world. And the way that I define niching is not as just about target market, but it's what's your role in the community. Or if we're going to translate that to business, what's the role in the marketplace that you want to be known for? Mm. And as soon as we move it out of just target market into role, that opens it up to a few more things. It opens it up to not just who we're trying to reach, but what we're doing and how we're doing it. That's actually a part of this role that we play. And, in fact, sometimes it's the defining thing. You know, for example, if I were to say, you know, think of if you're in your town, you've got like some raw food, superfood, cafe, restaurant situation, and then ask yourself, who is the target market for that? You'll find that pretty quickly that falls apart, because you can't just name one. You go there and you'll see there's the yoga people, but there are also older folks whose doctors have been like saying eat healthier, and maybe a naturopath sent them there. You've got vegetarians and vegans. You've got, you know, you've got a, there's a lot of different people. Mm. And if you were to do a kind of survey, maybe you'd end up that there were like 12 different target markets. And who are all coming for different reasons, wanting different things, maybe they've got different issues. But so in this scene, when niche gets talked about, niche becomes target market, and that gets defined as a particular kind of person with a particular kind of problem, which I think we're probably all familiar with.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So I just want to broaden it a bit and say that's still part of the picture. But it's not the whole picture. Maybe I'll kind of lay out the 7 steps. And with the extreme caveat that these are not necessarily always in this order. If I were to work through this with somebody, I tend to jump around a bit. But this is the general gist of it. And maybe just helpful to wrap our minds around it. So the first thing is, the other place that we get stuck, I think, in niching is looking at it as a linear thing. And we don't consciously do this, but it kind of sounds like I'm at point A, with no niche, and I want to be at point B where I have a niche. And we try that, and we think of a new niche, we try something, and then it fails or it doesn't feel good, and we ditch it. And the experience emotionally is like, shit, I've got to go back to the beginning and start at point A. So I'm starting all over again. And you can only go through that experience so many times before it's pretty exhausting and it starts to feel like a huge waste. And then you start to be scared of committing to anything because it's like you know the implications of the amount of work it takes to re-niche. So instead of it looking at like a line, I invite you to look at it like a spiral. So you're at kind of, if you imagine you're at the north point of that spiral. If you do a full spiral and you get back to north, yes, you're back where you were, meaning you're at north, but you're actually one step in. You're a little bit closer to the center where something that might resemble a workable niche would be. And so this process of having a way to think about niching that acknowledges the learning that goes on along the way is really critical. That we're not, you know, when you go get your bike fixed, when they're spinning the tire to see if it's balanced, they call it truing the tire because they're trying to take the wobble out of it. And it's what we're doing with the niche. We're kind of truing it as we go. You know, little tweak here, little twist of the knob there so that it doesn't have as much wobble and it's a smoother ride for us. And so the first thing that I'll look at is what do people want to offer? And that often comes from this question of what do they see that's missing in the community. So something that I invite everyone to kind of notice and sit with is, what is it that you see that's missing? And in fact, you're already doing something. But it's good to notice, like, what was it that I saw? There's two questions here. One is, it, what is it that I saw that was missing in the community or in the marketplace that had me even want to do this? And number two, what do I still see as missing? Is there something still missing, a role that I could play? Because there's something different about what you're offering than other people, I imagine. And if there isn't, it's a good chance to just, like, to start looking. Like, what is missing? What's nobody else doing that maybe I could do? So, you know, for example, if you live in a small town, there's no yoga studio. The what is the offer? It's, okay, I'm going to open a yoga studio. That's the what. That's just the thing you're putting out. It's the modality. It's the package. It's the offer. That's the what. Number two is kind of a corollary with this one, which is the why. And this is where you can learn a lot about yourself and about your niche, is when you look at, because you will notice that, so for everyone on the call, you're doing something, and I'm assuming you're doing it because at a certain level you're inspired to do it. You can't help yourself but doing it. You get paid better to do almost anything. but you've chosen for some reason to do this. And it's almost ridiculous. It's ludicrous given how challenging it can be. And, like, most of you could probably go work a corporate job and, like, do really well with it, and yet you've said no to that, and what's wrong with us?
Right, and maybe walked away from that corporate job.
Yeah, sure. Right, and all that security. And so it's like, yeah. There's a reason. There's something behind that. And it's good to check in with that, of like, why am I doing this? What got me involved? And there's something, if you're doing something, it's almost always because you saw there was something missing. And the fact that you noticed it is missing is not a given, because not everyone else notices that it's missing in the community.
Mm.
And even if they do, they don't care about it in the way that you do. And what that points to, that's the breadcrumbs to your life story. That there's something and some series of things that have happened in your life, good, bad, ugly, inspiring, that have led you to a place where you would even notice that. So it's something to pay attention to. So for me, you know, I wanted to do marketing for hippies because I had, you know, do workshops for people who were trying to do something good for the planet. And I started this, I don't know, 15 years ago. But why? It's because I was looking at it and it was like, well, it was missing. And I had gone through all this really, I'd learned a lot about sales in particular that just really felt uncomfortable to me. And I was wrestling with it and I was coming up with some realizations about it. And I just wanted to be able to share it and help people. Because I saw so many of my good friends just struggling to make enough money and it was painful to watch. And I thought maybe I had something to offer. And so it's just good to check in with that. There's often a lot of information. One of our colleagues, Jeffrey Van Dyke, he talks about often about how your deepest wounds are often a doorway to your truest niche.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the places we've struggled the most are often so I can't tell you how many times people, when they really nail their niche, it's like, oh, it's me 10 years ago.
Mm.
So it's if you're looking for the there's really no quick fix around niching. There's no magic bullet, but that's one of the questions of like that it just seems to often go in that direction. But because, of course, we struggled with something, we had to overcome it, we had to learn a lot, we have a lot of empathy for that, we understand the situation, and there's a natural credibility in that. So there's that. Third thing is the how. And so this is beyond just like, what are you offering, but how do you want to do it that's different? And this gets into the whole conversation about point of view, perspective, your voice, your aesthetic, your style. All of that shows up in this way. And often people are so boring and neutral in the way they put themselves out. And so this is just a chance for more style. You know, like our colleague Suzanne Falter-Barnes says, let your freak flag fly. you know, it's a good chance to like, how can I bring even more of myself and my personality and my perspective and philosophy into my business and infuse it in such a way that it's demonstrably noticeable. So, you know, the what would be, I'm going to build a boat to take people on these tours. But the how is like, how do you paint the boat? What kind of regalia do you wear when you're, you know, and the crew on the boat? What's the name of the boat? What type of boat, the style of it? All of that, so that when somebody's walking, they see a boat that's just like, oh, my God, that's my boat. I want to get on that one. And other people will be repelled, and that's fine. So that kind of – those three are the kind of what are we putting out. Then number four, we start moving into the who side of it, the marketing side of it, because that's the internal side. And there are two places that people get stuck with their niching. One is they stay in their head all the time, and they just think about it and ruminate it and steep in it all the time. And I don't know if you've noticed, but if you just stay in your head about things, this is where crazy happens. And people who just stay in their head all the time will come up with niches and business ideas that are just fucking terrible. Sorry for my language. You know, they're just no good because they're not grounded. They never had a conversation with a person. There's no actual need that it's meeting. And so it's dangerous to just think about it forever and not try anything. But the other place people get stuck is they go out and they do a bunch of stuff and they literally never reflect on it. Mm. So, you know, we need the balance. So this first part is the we're doing some reflecting on the what. But then we do need to reflect on the who. So the step number four is what I call the big circle. And in, I think, a lot of marketing lingo, this would be called your ideal client. And so this is the idea of just, like, generally, who do you want to work with? Because what I notice is there's certain things that are people would say, oh, I don't have a clear target market. And it was true they didn't have, like, a super tight target market, but they sort of took that to mean I don't know anything about who I want to work with. And the reality is they knew a lot about who they wanted to work with. The easiest exercise, the best homework I can suggest on this is you make a list of all your top 10 favorite clients and the top 10 worst clients you've ever had.
Mm.
And you just take them name by name. And this is a good one to sit down with a friend and do. But they would, you know, go through the names of group and be like, great, John Smith. Why did you love working with John Smith? And you would just talk about John Smith, name every single thing you could think about until there was nothing else left to say. Then you move on to the next name. And you do the same for the clients you didn't like. And at the end of that, you're going to have a list that's very clear and grounded about the specific things you want and don't want in clients. So when you think about the big circle, it's like in the middle is the big word yes, surrounded by a lot of little no's. And the big circle is where we start to filter out. We start to like, okay, who am I saying yes to and who am I saying no to in a general sense? You know, so it's like people who no-show me, you know, or show up late, or people who are difficult to work with in these particular ways. You may just decide you don't want to work with. And this is a really liberating moment for a lot of entrepreneurs because it's like, oh, my God, I can fire my clients.
Yeah.
I don't have to say yes to everybody. It's like it's an eye-opening revelation. And it's like, and people start to realize, oh my God, by saying no to these clients, I'm actually having more energy to make my business better and to work with the clients who I really love, and those people can find someone who's a better fit. So the big circle is where it's the general sense. And this is where like umbrella terms like conscious entrepreneur, heart-based entrepreneur can come into play. Though those terms are just frankly not that useful for your marketing strategy. They're good for you, and maybe they're good in a general sense for people to get a gist of what you do, but they don't tend to be terms that are going to land particularly strong. That's the work of the little circles, which is step five. And so if you imagine like a circle, and inside that circle, a little Venn diagram of three overlapping circles. So what I found with niching was one of my first workshops I did was in Seattle with a fellow named Dominic Canterbury, where he was the first one that kind of lifted up this language of niches and all this. And so when he started the workshop, we're just like, great, so pick your niche. And the eyes just deer in headlights, and people freaked out, and we just couldn't get it. It's like, yeah, just pick something, pick your niche, you know, and they just kind of melted down. And so we gave a little bit more time for it, and then kind of kept moving. And so the rest of the workshop wasn't as useful because they didn't have a niche to work with. But that made me think, like, oh, this is hard. So then next workshop is, let's do a whole morning on it. And then the next one, okay, we'll do a whole day. And then 2 days. And then, let's do a six-week program on it. And, you know, and I started to see, like, oh, even the 6 weeks isn't enough to nail it. And so there was just realizing how big a thing it was and to just pick one. But if I said to that same group in that first workshop, if I said, okay, everyone pick 12, that's overwhelming in a different way. And the kind of breakthrough I had to this, I was talking with Sherry Sonnen Moe, who's the author of Business Mastery, and she just kind of offhand, she said, oh, yeah, no, I would never recommend somebody have one target market. I always suggest having about three. And I was like, that feels so much better. And so I started working with people and inviting them to pick three, and what I noticed was it often, because once we'd pick three to work with, you would have one that kind of just stood out as the obvious place to start. And that often kind of became then their default main target market. But it was easier to get to when you allowed for a couple extra than just being totally exclusive about it. And so the big circle for me would be like conscious entrepreneurs. The little circles inside would be things like life coaches, holistic practitioners, permaculture people. Mm. Yeah. My mom and her husband have a tree farm called Sherwood's Forests. And the big circle, and this is the important thing to get about the big circle. Fundamentally, the big circle has to be defined by people who want what you offer. So the clearer your what is that you're offering and how you're offering it, the clearer that, that is, the clearer it's going to be for people if they want it or not. And when it's really generic and when it's really blah, nobody knows. They're neutral because you're neutral. There's not going to be much of a clarity on their side. I remember Dave Buck, who took over for Coachville after Thomas Leonard passed away. Somebody asked him. He was a life coach. They said, so what's your niche? And he said, people who like me. And that's actually brilliant. It's actually not a niche. What he's saying is he's trusting that there is something about who he is and the way he shows up in the world that resonates or not with people. And that can be enough, honestly. That can be enough as a niche. You know, just like, who the hell is the niche for this raw food super thing? People who want to go to a raw food super food, that's the big circle. Now, I still think it's useful to then dig a bit deeper into the target markets if you're going to want to be strategic about marketing, if you're going to want to do some outreach. You know, because that's like fundamentally like, who are the target markets for Van Gogh's paintings? People who like Van Gogh's paintings, period. That's the bottom line. And now it is still wise then to say, okay, well, if we were to look at that group of all these people that would like Van Gogh's paintings, we had to break it into three categories, who would they be? Mm-hmm. You know, the three main people to explore. Because it's just, where the hell do you find people who want to buy Van Gogh's paintings? That's hard. still nebulous. And so with people who want to buy trees, that's broad, that's really difficult. But they broke it down to landscapers, acreage owners, and garden supply stores. The technical term for identifying your target markets, your little circles, is called guessing. And because it's what you're doing. And you want to make your guesses as smart as you can, but you really are guessing. You're making certain assumptions, some of which will be proven untrue. So for my mom and her husband, they realized that garden supply stores were no good because they nickel and dime them, could get cheaper trees from the States, et cetera. Landscapers were no good either because they needed bigger trees. When people buy a landscape, they tend to just want it done. They don't want to buy a smaller tree that will grow, and so it didn't work out. But acreage owners actually ended up being huge. And then years later, they got found and discovered by reclamation companies. So now they really have functionally two little circles. So this is how it goes. You make some guesses about the little circles. And number I'm hearing some fuzzy business over there.
You're hearing fuzzy? I'm not hearing fuzzy. I can hear you just fine. Yeah, maybe your phone.
Okay. We're probably fine. So number six is this idea of niche experiments or doing little projects. And this is so important because one of the biggest places people melt down around their niche is this idea, and our colleague Bill Barron talks about this beautifully when he talks about this idea of dating your niche, that if I were to have been at that workshop years ago in Seattle, and instead of saying pick a niche, I were to say, great, you've got about half an hour. I want you to decide who you're going to marry if you're single. That would have been so stressful. If they'd taken it seriously, if that was meant as a serious exercise, it should be a stressful exercise. That's crazy. That's nuts. But it's a similar thing to ask people to pick their niche in that way. Before you marry somebody, you might want to date them for a while and get to know them a little bit. So there's that. And the way that we do that is by doing little tests, little experiments, little projects that get us out of our head and into a conversation with the real world. There's a great book called The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. He talks about this idea of the minimum viable product. Same kind of thing. You want to do a tiny test before you, because where people can make a big mistake is they, I've got a new niche, and so they redo their website, they change all their business cards, they change everything, and then the niche doesn't work out. That's a lot of money and time and effort to expend on that. So much better to do small things. So you test a workshop. Instead of saying I'm going to change my whole business to this, you do a little workshop on that, or you take 10 clients on that topic or issue at a discount, and you just to see, or you make an offer, not even at a discount, just to see what the response is and how you enjoy working with those people. You write a series of blog posts, you do some videos on it, you do a series of small things. This idea, before you move out to the country and go back to the land, it might be useful to have a garden in your backyard first, and maybe even some potted plants in your house before that. Just to start small. And then step seven is this idea of the reflection, where it's like once you've done that, once you've gone through all those experiments, you've picked a little circle because you want to do the niche experiment for a particular little circle. It's just going to work better. So in my parents, my mom and her husband's case, if you wanted to, let's say they picked acreage owners, well, as a little niche experiment, they might do a little sales letter to some acreage owners just to see what their response is. They might go to an event where they could find a lot of acreage owners and set up a booth fair in a small way. You just kind of test. And sometimes, by the way, the tests are just literally conversations. They found out with the garden supply stores, they just talked to enough of them and realized it wasn't going to work. And they talked to enough landscapers and realized it wasn't going to work. So sometimes that's what we mean by project. One of my favorite examples of this was my friend Javin Bernakovich, who's a permaculture practitioner. And there's a classic thing where people who go through a permaculture design certification, for those of you who know what it is, kind of basically working with the land in a really good way, and gardening is a part of it. But at the end of this, there'd be all these skills, and it, you know, everything from rainwater catchment to natural building to composting, all this stuff is in it. And so when people leave, it's like so much, and probably imagine like a lot of you listening to your trainings in whatever modality you had, you left with a ton. There were so many ways you could apply it. And so at the end of history, people often leave permaculture training as just kind of like overwhelmed, like, what do I do now with all of this? So Javin would ask them, he'd say a few questions. He'd say, okay, out of all the training, it's 2 weeks, what jumped out at you the most? What were the parts you were most excited about? And people would always have something. There'd be something that, you know, grabbed them more than other parts. Number two, he'd say, what's a meaningful need that you see in your community? And number three, what else are you really good at or skilled at outside of permaculture? And how could you weave those three together? And people would begin to think about it, come up with some rough ideas, and then he gave them this challenge. And this is just this is one of these ideas I wish, if I could go back in time and rip it off, I would. It's too good. But it's the 10 by 10 by 100 challenge. And it's this idea of, he told people, so you have 10 days. You can spend no more than 10 hours and no more than $100. Go and do something. Yeah. So giving people that, isn't that great?
That is awesome. Yeah. Yeah, because it really confines it.
Yeah, then it's like you just have to go out and try something. And people are stunned by what happens as a result of this. You know, they do something real tiny, but that opens all these doors to things they would never have considered and would never have happened if they'd just sat on their ass. And it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of conversation about commitment in these circles and being committed. And it's good to look at the etymological roots of committed, because commit comes from the Latin root commit, which means to begin. So there's that quote by W.H. Auden or whoever it was, until one is committed, there's hesitancy, always the chance to draw back, and ineffectiveness, that quote. try reading that quote again, understanding that commitment means beginning. What that quote is not saying is like, or maybe it's saying this too, but it's not just saying be tenacious and that's what makes the magic happen. What that quote is whispering to you is even starting something creates the magic. Just being willing to take a first step, that's what opens the doors. Yeah, and then number seven, we just reflect. We look back on what we learned. So we had this little circle, come up with a niche project, some way to explore it, and then we reflect and we learn from it. And this is not the throwaway step. This is actually, if somebody's been in business for a while, this is often where I'll have to start. Because what's happened is it's like they've been spending years harvesting grain from their farm, and they've got barley and rye and millet and wheat and corn and hemp and flax, and they've thrown it all in this grain silo, but just all in together. And they're like, why am I poor? And it's like, have you ever taken your grain to the market? No, that's why. So we've got to sell it. We've got to take it out to the market. But you open the door in the grain silo, and it's a disaster. It's a huge mess. It's literally never been organized. And the more you've done that, the more years and seasons you've been throwing grain in there, the more you've got to work through. But on the other side of it, once you've got it organized and sorted into all the different sacks, there's a fortune there. And so that instead of money, we're talking about clarity. So if somebody's been in business for 10 years and they've never actually stopped and reflected around their niche, it's the insights that people have are thunderous. There's so much there to learn about what they want to do, why they're doing it, how they want to do it, generally who they want to work with, who the target markets might be. So if I sit with somebody who's been doing it 10 years, it's like we can get – they are so much clearer than they realize they are. They don't even know how clear they are. They don't know how much grain and how much money they could get for it at the market, you know. Wow. So that's my general sense anyways.
I love that because what you described was a long, convoluted process that I went through to come to that. It's like fighting the whole idea of getting married right up front, you know, and cutting out and excluding all else, and then – coming back to, well, who do I love to work with? And then how do I like to work with them? And looking back, I really love it because I've up till now felt like, well, I've managed to not even do a niche thing.
Yeah.
But when I look at it from your perspective, I definitely have done that. And I love the concept of all the people who like me is a lovely concept.
Right. And the thing, the twist with that is, people who like me, that kind of statement is reserved for somebody who actually has a clear sense of who they are and is demonstrating that in the world.
Yeah.
That statement does not work very well for somebody who's just trying to fit in and be a people pleaser and not be offensive to anybody and making themselves just really kind of shut down and tiny if that's not who they are. There's a great book by a guy named Matt Cumming called Polarize. But it's about this notion in marketing where, there's only three kinds of clients that you're ever going to run into, potential clients, and they each take a different response. And there's the yeses, the maybes, and the nos, basically. Mm-hmm. The yeses are people who you meet who just love you right away, get what you're doing right away, and are just like, how can I work with you?
Yeah.
They're leaning in. They're interested. They're curious. they may not work with you for years, but that you know that they're already in. It's just a timing and a money issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, they're the no's. And the no's are people who just, as soon as they hear what you do, they're rolling their eyes. They're like, oh, my God, you're a total flake. They're not into it. They don't dig it.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, they're the maybes. and the maybes are neutral in response to you. They're not turned off by you, but they're not turned on by you. They're not running away, but they're not coming any closer. So those are the three, yeah? And so with the yeses, the strategy is like, get out of the way and enjoy it. Stop trying to sell them and prove how great you are to them. They're already in. It's good. The no's, let them go. Bless and release. Do not try to chase them or change their mind. If it's genuinely a no, the amount of work it would take to change their mind is ridiculous. It's just there's no margin in that. So that leaves the maybes. And what do we do with them? And that thing that's critical to get is that for most entrepreneurs, there are maybe 10% yes, 10% no, and 80% maybes. You know? So most of who we run into, it's a maybe. And the question then becomes, why so many maybes? Which is important to grapple with because we've got to understand that the maybes almost always turn into no's. But there's this hope. We get filled with this hope that our pipeline is full with all these potential clients and prospects. But they're actually not yeses that are in waiting. They're maybes that are probably going to turn into a no. Now, why do they turn into a no? Because they eventually meet somebody who's a total yes for them, and they go with them, and you become a no. you know, they're sitting there thinking, maybe. You're sitting there thinking, oh, hopefully. And then it doesn't work out. So the reason that they're so neutral to us is because we're being neutral. Yeah? And this gets to the how we're doing what we're doing. We're being so generic and neutral that it evokes that response in them. And another way to say this is we are not being vulnerable because we know if we were to actually be more upfront about who we are and how we see things, people might reject us. I just wrote a blog post a few weeks ago called Get Rejected Faster because the reality is that rejection is still coming. You know, they're going to find out who you are eventually anyways. So you might as well just cut to the chase on that one. You know, if there's something that's really true for you, then it's probably best that people just know that about you. And it will get a more polarized response. And the more vulnerable people are willing to be about who they are, and how they see the world, and how they run their business, and what they do and what they don't do, the more you're going to get people loving and hating what they do. You're not going to get an 80% maybe. You'll get way fewer, ideally no maybes, and people just know immediately when they see it if they want it or not. You know?
Wow. Yeah. It's a great concept. It's a great concept. But it's a scary one, too, because you're thinking, wow, what if all those 80% turn into no's? And you take it as a personal thing too, right? Because it's no longer about your business and you're putting out there, oh, yeah, you want to learn how to eat healthy and have more energy? It's more about they're rejecting you, not what you do. So So that's where, when you said vulnerability, it gets scary for people.
And they might be rejecting you. That's possible. I mean, they're not really, because they don't know you. You know, it's questionable if you know you, actually.
That's true.
So it's like, so there's a level where, no, it's not you. It's not about you. They're just rejecting the offer. They're rejecting a vibe they felt from you in that moment. That's all they were saying no to. And you don't know what would happen in the future. They might come back and actually want to work with you. And there's a level where, yeah, okay, they're rejecting you. But if that's true, that was coming anyways. So all we're doing is delaying it and actually making it much more painful for them and uncomfortable for them and much more uncomfortable for ourselves.
Yeah.
Because in the waiting, we're lurking, we're staying in touch with them, we're checking in with them, you know, and you can transpose everything I just said to dating, and it gets really clear.
Yeah.
You know, what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Totally. I was just thinking that as you said that, you know, as as in a relationship thing, if you make out that you're this whatever, successful, blah, 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 and that's not who you really are, you're just delaying the rejection or the, you know, the not working out of that relationship. So
right. Or if you're on a date, you know, if a guy's on a date with a woman and she's really into him and he keeps bragging about how great he is.
Yeah.
There's a certain point where it's like you're trying too hard.
Right.
And it's actually a turnoff. Or, you know, she's not into you and you keep trying to impress, and it's just like, let it go. Move on. There are other people in the world. They're just not that into you, and that's okay. And so when people are like, oh, but it's vulnerable and it would hurt more, it's like, let's not pretend that it doesn't hurt to chase people who are not into us. And let's not pretend that it doesn't hurt to be having people look at us in such a neutral way.
Yeah.
And to be waiting and hoping. And just to get that, like, hope is not a strategy.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we spray and pray, we call it, you know, or the hope marketing. And that's kind of what I did for many, many years. It's like, I'm not going to put myself out there. I'm not going to pay money to have advertising. I'm going to not really just get in people's face, because what if they say no?
Yeah.
So I just hide and say, well, if they find me because somebody told them about me, they'll find me. And then so I think that what you said, I think at the beginning, was that finding that middle ground of not just hiding away and hoping people find you, but not getting out there and using all the sleaze techniques, but finding that, and really boils down to just be real.
Totally. And it's the other thing I would want to just lift up is for everyone to try this on the size. You can't not have a niche. That's actually not possible. The question is not, do you have a niche or don't you? You have one right now. Everyone listening has this. So again, if we're defining that for business as a role in the community that you're known for, congratulations, you have one. So that's not the issue. We can drop this question of do you have a niche or not and get to the real business of, is this the role that you want to be playing?
Mm.
Is this what you want to be known for? Do you want to be known as the generalist who just kind of knows a little bit about everything and can help everyone, sort of? Like, is that the rep that you want to have? And if it is, wonderful. And there are certain situations where that might actually be the most appropriate thing. So there's nothing wrong with it. But it's just like, am I attracting the kinds of people I actually most want to work with or not? Because you can't get everybody. That's just not a thing. So you've already got a reputation. You've already got a niche. You've got this platform or brand or whatever you want to call it that you're known for. You're already occupying a space and a role. And it's just good to look at that and be like, is this it? Is this really satisfying? Like, because they're, you know, it's just like, is this fulfilling for me? And is it profitable for me? Is this actually working? And if not, then we might want to look at occupying a different niche. You know, in an ecosystem, a niche is, it's not describing a particular thing in the ecosystem. It's describing the place that it occupies.
Mm.
You know, it's describing
a nest, right? It's a place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a place. It's a function in the ecosystem. And, when you introduce, so like, there's this amazing YouTube that everyone should watch about when they reintroduced wolves into Yellowstone Park. Because there hadn't been any there. And so what was happening was the deer and the moose or whatever were going down to the river and eating the grass along the river, which was having more of the soil kind of fall down into the river, which was da-da-da-da. When the wolves came, there just wasn't as much traffic from them down in the open plains there by the river, the open areas, which meant less breakdown, and it changed the course of the river, just reintroducing them. So what it meant was there was this empty space. There was a niche for wolves or predators in that ecosystem that was not occupied. And somebody came in and occupied it. And in every community, there are these like roles that nobody's playing this role. And when somebody shows up and plays it, boom, there's this response, and it has this real dramatic, hopefully positive impact on the community.
Yeah, even if it is a small part of the community, I mean, obviously, if you're trying to be successful, you don't want something where you're just going to attract them. There's like five of the people in the whole world that are going to fit into that place. But on the other hand, you know, if there are five people who are going to pay you a lot of money and be your clients for life, that could be good too.
Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on the business model.
Right, right. I know some people with very successful models where they take on between 6 and 10 very high paying clients each year. Very successful, multi-six-figure businesses. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. People will think it's like, oh, my niche. And it's good to, if we look at the role we want to play, it's good to make the distinction between that and being famous. Being famous is the toxic mimic of having a niche.
Mm.
Being famous is it's just having a spotlight shown on you. That's all. And when people go for the spotlight and the attention on themselves, as opposed to filling a particular role, I just think it ends up being shallow and hollow. And it doesn't necessarily equal profitable, having a lot of people and a lot of attention. You know, it's like, that doesn't equal money necessarily.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I remember somebody telling me recently about somebody who, you know, has been on Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz and, you know, travels all over and is on these TV shows, but doesn't have any back-end marketing. And it's broke
Amen.
All the time.
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the things I say that often sort of jars people up my workshops is just like, marketing actually doesn't make you any money. That's not the function of marketing. Your business model makes you money or not, period.
Right.
If the business model is good, sales funnels or whatever you want to call it or model you want to use, that's the thing. It either works or it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Marketing is just getting people to the door to actually start working with you.
Well, that's attracting them, right? That's not necessarily enrolling them. So sales or enrollment is what we, you know, is that next step, which a lot of people fall short on. They attract a whole lot of people.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's interesting, too, because I'm a fan. Peter Drucker had a line where he said the goal of marketing is to make selling redundant.
Mm.
And so to me, I don't know if it's always achievable, but I think it's a worthwhile challenge because we tend to look at marketing, that the goal of marketing is to get people to say yes. And that's how we know we've succeeded. That's the metric we use. And I think there are actually three roles in marketing. And I got this from a great book. This is my kind of spin on it anyways, from a book called Monopolize Your Marketplace. But they talk about three roles. One is to get people's attention so they actually know that you're there. But the second one is to filter, to establish if it's a fit or not, to help them make a good decision, whether that's yes or no with you. And third is to lower the risk of them taking the first step.
Mm-hmm.
But that second step of filtering, to me, it's like that's the primary thing. That's the heavy lifting in marketing. That, you know, recently one of the things I've wanted to do this for years, and I finally just got around to doing it, is so when people sign up for one of my last online programs, when they read, it was, you know, the typical long sales page because there's just a lot to say, and they clicked on the purchase button. But instead of it just taking their money at that point, it took them to a page that I'm calling the Are You Sure page.
Oh.
And that page has a minute-long video on top, and it's just me being like, hey, you just thanks so much for wanting to sign up for the program. Before you do, my guess is you probably skimmed that sales letter just like I do, but there's actually important stuff in it to see if this is really right for you or not. And I wouldn't want you to sign up for this if it wasn't actually a fit for you and the right timing and all that. So I've cut and pasted all the most important bits from the sales letter that could help you figure out if it's a fit or not. And I'm going to ask you to please stop now and just reread those. And if it still feels like a fit, please sign up. But if not, I hope you'll find something better. And so I've done that on two different programs now, and people are just delighted. The people who sign up harder.
Yeah,
you know,
committed.
They're just like, I'm in, because they really have to check in, like, God, is this the right timing? Is this? So when they sign up, it's like this doubly committed place, which is good. And the people who don't, there's such good vibes about it, because they realize, like, oh, my God, you know what? I actually don't have the time to do this right now, and I'm going to come back later and work with you, and I feel so good about this. I feel so honored and respected.
Yeah.
And it just builds that goodwill. But so all that to say, marketing for me has really shifted to becoming this filtering process. But the heavy lifting of the filtering is this conversation around niche.
Yeah. I love this.
Yeah, there's got to be this internal clarity of, like, who is it that I want to work with?
Yeah.
And what is it that I'm offering? Like, I mean, there's that coffee shop in Edmonton called Credo, and this one lady came up and she was ordering a coffee and she started, like, giving her list of demands of how she wanted the coffee. Like, can you make it like this and this and this? And the guy listened and he was just like, nope, we make coffee the way we make it, and we think you'll like it, you know? So he's just very clear, this is what we do. We don't do that mm-hmm. thing you want. We don't do it. And so it's like, you have a choice. You can either – and she was just like, yeah, okay, I'll take it. And then, of course, she loved it. So you don't have to, like, do the dance for everybody and try to please everybody. Part of what is going to filter is you just being really clear, like, I do this, and this is the way I do it.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, go away. If you like
go find someplace else. And I like that because, you know, a lot of those folks who would turn away at that point because maybe they signed up too quickly because you were just so good at creating an irresistible offer or whatever, they come back later, a lot of them anyway, and they ask for a refund. Or they don't ask for a refund, but they don't actually participate. And so then they don't become these beacons and they don't continue to participate. They don't become ongoing customers, clients. So I think it's wise. It's scary. I mean, to me, when you said that, I'm like, oh, my God, you know, because you like that rush of, oh, yeah, we just did this webinar and this slew of people just signed up or whatever.
Totally.
But on the other hand, to really it's almost contrary to what we're taught in marketing, which is to create that emotional impulse buy.
Yeah, that's the fucked up part of it. Sorry if I'm swearing so much. But that's the it's to consider how disturbing that is.
Yeah.
Because what I'm saying in that is, like, my needs are more important than your needs. Whenever we come at any interaction from the standpoint of designing that interaction for us to get the response that we want, it is manipulative. When we go into a marketing or selling situation with the where our whole goal is about getting them to say yes, that's where sales pressure comes from. It comes from our agenda.
Yeah.
To get the sale. That's what they're responding to. That's what objections are, is them fighting for their independence and feeling on this energetic level that we don't respect them at all and we're just trying to bully them. That's where all these walls come up. Without it, you're just having a conversation with somebody. They're asking questions and you decide if it's fit or not. It's this real natural human conversation. That's what happens when you go in with the agenda to get to the truth of if it's a fit. And when the truth becomes the actual agenda, you know, and I'm not saying then you have to do small numbers all the time. But what happens is you start to realize, okay, if I design my marketing as a filtering process, these are my numbers. So if I want, you know, like I'm going to get, if I speak to a group of 100 people, I'm going to get 20 people to sign up instead of the 50 that I might have gotten if I did the rush to the back of the room and all the social proof. And I'm not even saying don't use social proof, but it's like, or don't use any of these tactics, but I'm just saying if it's designed with the intention genuinely to help them decide what's best for them by letting them know this is what this is what it isn't, this is who it's for, this is who it isn't for, you know, if that's the intention is to make sure they're as informed as possible, that doesn't mean you don't then do your best to take out the risk for them and do the best numbers you can, but the numbers you're looking for are numbers that are actually a fit, where they're going to be in the right place and really get value from it. And because then if you go, like, okay, I do a presentation to 100 people on average, I get 20 people and I want 100 people in my new program, then it's like, great, I have to do 5 or 6 of those intros.
Right.
And then you just know that and you stop being like, I need 100 people, and here's 100 people here, so I need all of them in this one presentation.
Mm.
That's where things start to feel really uncomfortable. When we instead do the heavy lifting, because if we don't do the heavy lifting of like who's a fit, that's what we're putting on their shoulders. And if we're always going to be learning, this is a never-ending process, you know, which is why it's the spiral, because you're going to work with a bunch of people and you start to realize, like, and here's a way to do that, by the way. Whenever somebody asks for a refund, what they're mm-hmm. telling you is that at some level, it's not a fit.
Right.
There is a chance they're just screwing you. That's possible.
Yeah.
But I would come from the, it might be useful to move from a place of the benefit of the doubt that they're actually just telling you the truth, that for some reason it wasn't a fit. What that should tell you very clearly is that there was something in your marketing process and selling process that did not filter them out.
Mm.
There's some way that they didn't know that. And so it's good to then go back to those people, refund their money, and you go back to them and say, so here's your money, and you know what? I get it. This wasn't a fit for you. I believe you on that. And it just tells me there's something missing. Would you be willing to take a look at my sales page or just tell me what's there that shouldn't be or what isn't there that should be that would have let you know in advance that this wasn't a fit?
Mm.
And they will tell you things. They're going to give you the best feedback, just a little bit here, a little bit there, and your sales pages start to get more and more refined until you don't have people who aren't a fit signing up anymore. You know, because you'll realize, they're like, I didn't realize how much time it was going to take to do this program. And then you say, okay, great. And then you sit down, you're like, okay, how long did this take people? 20 hours? Okay. So then in your sales letter you say, don't sign up unless you have 20 hours to spend on this.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, and they say, I didn't realize it was going to be using a Facebook group as a conversation, and I'm not on Facebook. Oh, thank you. Okay, so you add that in, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody, one of my clients, Carmen Spaniola, I read this on her sales letter, and I loved it. It said, if you're into theosophy and ascended masters and spiritual hierarchies and all that, we're probably not a fit.
Mm.
So that was just from her lived experience of working with people. It's like, oh, I see things so differently, and it just never – the way I talk seems to grind against the way they see things. So instead of everybody being miserable, she just cuts to the chase and like, this is probably not going to work for you. And so they don't sign up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I sometimes say to, you know, this isn't for you if you're looking for that magic bullet solution and you just want a pill or a natural remedy that we can just hand you and fix all your problems.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not willing to work.
And I would say that's a good start, but then it's good to drill more specific, because I think the magic bullet one, you know, I see that in a number of sales letters, but it's like, if you're not willing to work, then it's like quantifying that work.
Mm.
How much time, what kind of work are we talking about, you know, what kind of tools are they going to need for that work? The more specific we can make it, and that's just the only place that comes from, unfortunately, is going to be experience. You'll do your best to lay that out, but then you're just going to get feedback from people that it didn't work. And then it's a chance to learn, and you just make it better and better. And by the way, the people, when you respond like that, when you refund and say, can you help me? They feel so good. They leave that interaction feeling so good. And they're like, this person really cares to make sure that nobody else goes through that like me. And they're actually now more likely to talk about you with other people. Because sometimes, like, you know, this wasn't a fit for me, but there's probably other people that would be.
Mm.
And so if you honor their no in that way, then when they leave, they just feel real good. And they do want to talk about you. So
I like that. The only thing that comes to mind as you talk about that is, do you run the risk of TMI, like giving them too much information before they've gotten... You know, there may be a lot of work down the road, and maybe there's some simple steps at the beginning, or maybe they're going to start to feel better after they do the first few steps, and then it's going to make it easier for them to do the rest.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you don't want to paint too gloomy a picture on the one hand, but you also don't want to make it seem like it's just like a cakewalk.
Sure. Yeah, right. Because if you just if all you do is talk up the possibilities of it, then they get in, they get kind of tackled by the challenges because they weren't expecting it, it's no good. But if all you do is talk about how hard it's going to be and they don't see the possibility in it, then it's just, why would I sign up for this? It just seems like
exactly.
a slog
with
no possibility. So, yeah, you've got to – it's got to be both in the sales letters. And I just think it's good to be really honest. Like, I think about the old Billy Blanks Tybo infomercials We're just like, I'm going to be honest with you. This is hard work. I'm not going to lie. This is, you got to work hard. They just kept saying that. But it was, but so I think that kind of attitude of just being very clear of like, this is the, what can come out the other side. And it's pretty extraordinary. And here are a few chunks that are difficult and that I want you to know about so you can make an informed decision of, do you want to do this or not?
Right. Yeah.
So I think it's good to hold both.
And a lot of us here in this world, in this position, in the group, are in the mode of not so much sales pages, but those enrollment conversations, where it makes it a lot easier to just really get at what's holding them back, or what might hold them back, and how.
How it's funny, Mike, because I haven't done a lot of enrollment conversations. That hasn't been my thing as much. The thing I would lift up is, well, if you're getting good results from the enrollment conversations, meaning the people who are sitting down with you are fit for the most part and the numbers are good for you and it's sustaining you, then ignore everything I'm about to say. But personally, I would just never want to sit down with somebody unless I already knew they were a fit. To me, that's like a nightmare of wasting my time trying to like see if it's a fit. Like if somebody reached out to me, is like, I'm thinking about coaching with you, and I don't do a ton of one-on-one coaching, but if I was going to create those coaching packages, it would be something along the lines of, yeah, cool, I'm open to that. Here's something I want you to read, and there's this video that I want you to watch that goes over, if people want to coach with me now, there's a 2.5-hour video. It's like $80. They have to buy it and watch it.
Oh, wow.
Before
we coach.
See,
the barriers to entry, right? So you don't get a lot of tire kickers.
Yeah. It's like, I don't get, but then when they show up, we've got a common language and we've got all that. So I just think it's good to think of the filtering even then, like to notice what kind of people you're getting and to notice when it's not a fit, why isn't it a fit? And what are those patterns? And see if you can weave that into whatever kind of sales process you have so that those people, you don't end up sitting with them.
Yeah.
And the people who really are a fit, who you love the most, those are the ones who are drawn in. But it's just constantly refining it. It's not like you do it and it's done. It's just, you could do that after every person or just every month you sit down. What did I learn from last month? And refine the selling conversation. Because what you ideally want, well, I'm not going to tell you what you want. What I want is if I'm going to start doing these enrollment conversations, I want to process ideally that every single person who sits in front of me is a yes.
Mm.
They're not a maybe. They're not a no. They're a yes. And now we're just talking about details and timing and money. And now we're just going through the, like, they're getting a sense of my vibe. I'm getting a sense of their vibe. We're just kind of seeing the finer points of, is this a fit? And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm really, I'm doing the typical enrollment thing where I'm like, what do you want? Where are you now? What's in the gap?
Right.
But it's so funny. But this is the other thing, that whole framework of the enrollment conversation. Where are you at? What do you want? Where are you at? What's in the gap? Here's how I can help you. Those four steps.
Mm-hmm.
You can go through those four steps with the intention to get them to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a qualitatively different experience than if you go through those four steps with the intention to see if it's a fit. Because if I do it like to get them to say yes, then what I'm doing is, as they're saying what they want, I'm like, okay, that's leverage. Where are they at now? Okay, that's the pain. Let me just screw that in a little tighter so they feel that. And let me create this gap. Let me widen that gap as much as possible so they're suffering and craving that thing as much as possible. Let's talk about what's in the gap. And then I'm going to make this pitch that exploits the emotional pain that they're in. That's what comes from that. But if I'm really in it to just see if it's a fit, I'm like, okay, where are they? What do they want? And I'm actually listening, like, is that a result I can help them get? Where are they at now? Is that a problem I can help them with? What do they see in the gap? Is that something I can help them with? And then at the end, I'm just going to be real honest and say, so here's the piece I think I can help with. Here's how long I think that would take. Here's what would be involved from you. Here's how much that costs. Here's a few different tiers of that. Where do you think we should go from here?
I
just leave it with them,
Yep.
Yeah. But so it's like, because I'm not stoked about using any of the tactics or just going for the close or overcoming objections, that just means I need to be better at filtering.
Right.
I need to make sure that people who are sitting there are worth having a conversation with.
Right. I get it. Yeah. And we use like an application process, a detailed like 3 or 4 page application process. And I've shared with folks here kind of a consultation pre-consult form that people have to really tell us what are your habits, so they're telling us a lot of information before we even get there, and we could say, yeah, this person's not going to work for it, or no,
yeah.
Or yeah, this person does seem, but you're right. I think it's a lot of us will have that tendency to want to just maybe overlook some of the things that we're going through, or maybe this isn't a good one, to just mm-hmm. because we're like hungry and we want to go for that close. And I like the idea of just changing the framework to seeing if it's a fit, but also having those things in place before that, you know. And it goes back to the niche thing, right, is knowing who you really want to work with, and maybe having some designing a questionnaire with those questions that you could easily tell, ooh, this is, this person is not, he's more like Charlie over here, which is in the don't like to work with, you know, versus Mary over here in the do like to work with.
And
I bet you
know,
could even use that, you know, those
you
questions.
Can. You can.
Yeah.
And it's good to, one last distinction I'll put out is this distinction between, you can be explicit versus exclusive. One doesn't necessarily mean the other. Meaning, let's say you decide, okay, for marketing's sake, I'm going to focus on coaching single dads. And you buy the website, singledadcoaching.com, and when you stand up at networking events and say, what do you do? It's like, I help single dads overcome the trauma of divorce. And all your business cards say single dad coaching. You get the decal on your cart. It's like, you know what I'm saying? Everything is single dad coaching. So there are two choices then you have, because, of course, now you're going to start attracting single dads. And you could decide to be exclusive. And this is the thing that terrifies most people. But you could decide that. You know, somebody else could come to you, a married woman, and you could say, no, you know what, I only work with single dads. That's all I do. But you don't have to. And that's the important thing to get, that if you wanted to be explicit but not be exclusive, you might have 30, 40, 50% of your clients not be single dads. Because what will happen is those single dads get such good results, and they're like, you know, I've got my friend Barry, and he's married, but his marriage is in trouble, and I feel like, man, I wish I'd had you before I got to work. Would you work with him? And you can say yes.
Yeah.
So you don't have to shut everyone else out at all when you decide what your little circles are. Just because you have those three little circles, it doesn't mean that, like, I've had people like mortgage brokers come to my workshops who don't fit in any of my little circles. And now the truth is, I could say you can't come, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But for me, I don't need to. And so, you know, if you're a real estate person, a mortgage broker, you're a lawyer, you're a whatever, sure, come on in. And I'm just clear, though. I'm explicit. This is who this is for. You know, I've had people come to my workshops and they sell crafts and things. And I'm just like, just a disclaimer, this workshop is primarily for service providers, so I'm not sure how useful it's going to be for you. I know there's some stuff and it can be, you know, twisted, and I'll do my best to support that. And that's not what this workshop is. This isn't how to grow your crafting business. And then they get to make the choice.
Right.
As long as you're clear with them, then they might come in and they still get a ton out of it and they love it. Or they don't get a lot out of it. They're like, well, man, you told me. You were right. But thanks anyways. But it's not a bad vibes because, it's such a gorgeous feeling when you're talking with somebody and you get this clear sense that your well-being matters more to them than making money. And where they're like, you know, you get the sense of like, hey, look, if I can't help you, I want to refer you to somebody else. And here's some other people worth checking out. And you can tell they're really in the conversation. There's nothing in them that's trying to convince you of anything.
Right.
They're just trying to, like, listen for, is this a fit? Can I help? It's the conversations become so wonderful to have.
Yeah.
No longer is this, there's no tension anymore in the conversations. There's no fear to have. Because there's nothing you're trying to hide anymore.
Yeah, I love it.
You know? And in fact, people will still sometimes think you're just trying to sell them. That'll come up just because of the nature of the dynamic and what it triggers in people. And then you can just be like, hey, I just want to slow down a little bit. I'm really not trying to sell you. If this isn't a fit, I'd love to see if I can help you find somebody else. I'm really just trying to see if this is a fit on both of our sides. You know, and you can, it's like the best thing I've seen on this, Ari Galper as a website, unlockthegame.com. Mm-hmm. And he was the first person I really got this from is that the art of selling should actually be the art of diffusing pressure, not the art of overcoming objections.
Hmm. I like that.
But you can't
diffuse
pressure.
They say that again.
Pressure.
Diffusing
so the art,
pressure.
He didn't actually say, this is my paraphrasing, so I've
okay.
never said it before, but that the art of selling should properly be the art of diffusing pressure, not the art of overcoming objections.
Yep.
And it's, it's a different kind of conversation.
It's a different conversation.
That comes from walking in with a comfort in your skin and knowing who you are, what you're offering, how you're offering it, and knowing who it's most likely to be a fit for, and still having some openness that maybe you're wrong, but coming, you know, just wanting them to know, here's what I know so far about what I do and who it's a fit for. And I'm open that I might be wrong, and this still might help you, but let me just do my best to make sure that we're both taken care of here.
And it goes back to what we talked about earlier, which is being real. And
yeah.
I think about the art of niching, I'll say it the Canadian way, the art of niching being really being real. Because if you're real in your sales page or your offer and you're not trying to be everything to everyone, you're really clear who you can best serve. You're being authentic.
Yeah.
Then those people who resonate will come, but some of the others may like your energy. They like the way you say things,
totally.
And they'll come, but they're the one that's choosing. You didn't deceive them into thinking it was for them.
And it's important that we don't deceive ourselves that people are going to long-term work with us if they didn't choose it.
Right.
You know, Simon Sinek wrote the book called Start With Why, and in the beginning of it, he has this part where he kind of breaks down, here are the sales tactics that people use. And he's like, I won't dispute that they work in terms of they'll get people to buy. But what they do not buy is loyalty. What they don't buy is trust.
Right.
It's the short-term game. So it's like, if you want to just go in front of a room and close as many people as possible, there are a lot of workshops I could tell you about. There's a lot of tactics you could do that will work. I prompt,
I know.
So,
I've been fallen into those preys. Yes, I know.
And how shitty does it feel when you realize you got sold on a program that wasn't a fit for you? It's the worst feeling.
It's like
I got lied to. I spent all this time and this money, and now it's hard to get a refund, and there's ill will everywhere. It's the worst. I hate it so much.
And
I've seen it. I've seen so many of my clients go through it.
Yeah.
You know, here's another filtering move. Suzanne Falter Barnes and Jeffrey Van Dyke, I went to their spiritual marketing quest, and on Saturday night they did their pitch for their next level stuff. And then they said, we're not going to let anyone sign up tonight. You have to sleep on it because this is a lot of money. We'd love for people to make a decision tomorrow by 11 a.m. if you're in or not. It would just be helpful for us. And that's when the deals are good until. So there is a bit of a limiter. There is some kind of scarcity. We're just naming that.
Yes.
But we're not going to let you buy tonight. This is not a rush to the back of the room thing. This is a go sleep on it. See if it's really, you know, so it's like putting in those moments that invite people. In fact, enforce slowing down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's like
so
questioning
the
their yes. It's like, you say, right. Because the impulse buy also leads to impulse requests for refunds.
Right.
And people in your workshops who shouldn't be there, and then you're sitting there and somebody's just draining the energy from the whole group because they shouldn't be there in the first place, and they're complaining and they're high maintenance, and then when they leave they bitch about it and you've got bad word of mouth to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just functional. It's like bad because marketing is fundamentally word of mouth. That's actually how marketing works at the end of the day, is people telling people. And so if you make your marketing about filtering fundamentally, and everyone who's in your stuff should be there, and they rave about it, you get that good word of nothing but good word of mouth.
Yeah.
Versus this thing where you do a workshop and half the people shouldn't totally be there, and so the whole experience is less for everybody, and everybody leaves either complaining or like, well, it was all right, and one or two people had an amazing time.
Yeah.
It's just long term, you start to look at the math of that, and every conversation all those people will have, and you just start to be like, oh, it's so much more profitable and easier for me to filter, to do that work up front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. That's awesome. Awesome. And everything that keeps coming through to me is the word authenticity and everything that you're saying. Just really being true to who you are, who you most like to work with, and making sure that, you're authentically communicating that message.
Amen.
In everything you do. So I'm curious. I don't know how many other people are curious, but I'm curious how those pay as you wish kind of thing. I know when you were first conceiving of that and thinking about doing it, I remember having a conversation in a group with you on that. But I just wanted to see, how does that work, and how do people actually pay? And you must be making money doing it, or must be keeping yourself afloat doing it. So how does that work? Tell us about that.
Oh, man, that is properly a several-hour conversation.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It is, but the nutshell I can give is it's kind of modeled after street performing. So the idea is I do the whole workshop, and then at the very end, they're invited to pay whatever they want to pay. And the impetus of it is several things. There's some selfish motives for me, and then there's some selfless motives. On the selfless side, it's people aren't broke because they're stupid. It's just life happens, and gives people a way to get access to important information in a way that preserves their dignity. The people who are doing the most radical work in the world often have smaller margins, and I want them to have access to this stuff so that their good businesses can grow. On the selfish side, for pay what you can, especially in the hippie market, it's really good word of mouth. People love it, and they talk about it, and they feel more comfortable spreading the word because it's not a $2,000 workshop. It's a pay what you can. I don't have to do a heavy pitch, which I love. If I do an intro, I don't have to be like, do this crazy presentation. I just like, if you like this intro, we're covering more of this in the weekend. It's a pay what you can. You can come. So that feels nice for me. And it it puts the onus on me to deliver, not them to get value.
Yeah.
And that just feels proper. It's like if I watch a show on the street, at the end, I don't want them to like make me feel guilty that I didn't enjoy their show and that I should pay them more. It's like, no, do a better damn show. You know, this is your job, not mine. So I feel like I kind of like that. It just feels like it kind of galvanizes me to do the best job possible. I'm like, hey, I better really show up. So the thing, it's been interesting because people use checks less than they used to. So it's actually shifted a bit for me, and I haven't done as many workshops in the last while, but what I realized was most entrepreneurs are cash flow poor. So when I first did it for a weekend workshop, I was just pay with one check, and I would get, I don't know, it was like $150, $200, somewhere, usually $150, which was fine for me because like I spent so little time marketing it. Because it's so easy to do with pay what you can. But then I was like, I wonder if I could do this. And so one of the workshops, I said, the deal is you pay with three checks at the end, one payable immediately, two post-dated anywhere over the next year. And then I started getting, how much was it? It was like $300, $400 a person. And then I switched it. The one I landed on was you pay with four checks, one payable now, three post-dated over the next year. And that brought it to like anywhere from like $400 to $800. There was one workshop in Toronto where it was an average of $800 a person.
That's amazing. So you basically have a payment plan on a pay what you can. I mean, that's essentially what it works out to be. That's so cool.
It's shifted a bit because people don't use checks and they use PayPal and Square and credit card and email money transfer. So the numbers actually dropped because people weren't just doing a single payment. And I just haven't been grappling with it as much because I haven't been doing it as much lately. But if I were to go back into doing it, and one of the things also that I did was when people would sign up, there were some people, this is the shadow side of pay what you can, most people don't assume, and I didn't assume would be there, is people can actually be very uncomfortable about it walking in just because, like, what if I don't pay enough and how much am I supposed to pay? And that can be a stressful thread throughout the whole experience. And so one of the things I did was when people would go to sign up, there were three options to sign up. One was, so it's a 3.5-day weekend. You can pay in full if you'd like $1,800. You can do a four pay, or you can just do pay what you can, and I encourage you to sign up pay what you can. That's how almost everyone does it. I've never had anyone click the pay in full, but I have had a couple people do the four pay because they just feel cleaner about just paying it up front and not having to think about it, and they can afford it, and it's fine. And the additional benefit of that is it gives people some context of because I resisted doing it, honestly, because people for years would say, well, what do you suggest that I pay? And I would be like, I'm not giving you an answer because I don't want to give you here's what the average is so then if you can't afford that, you feel diminished or less or whatever. But I just found it was so stressful. So it's useful to say, if I were to charge for this, this is what I charge.
That's what I would charge. Mm-hmm.
But that's not saying that's what you should pay because you might not get very much out of this workshop. I don't know, you know. And you may not have a lot of money.
Right.
And you may, you know, so the most I've gotten is $1,800 from one person, and the least I've gotten is like
$5. $5.
Seems to,
yeah. What was the deposit?
But, you know,
is that the deposit? Is that what you think?
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Deposit?
That's a really good. Yeah, I found with Pay What You Can, if I didn't do a deposit, there were so many no-shows, and it made me angry.
Yeah.
You know, you book a room, you get the workshop, printed and all that. So so for a day-long workshop, it's a $25 deposit. Pay What You Can, just one payment at the end. For a weekend, it was a $100 deposit plus Pay What You Can at the end.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then there were just so many fewer no-shows.
Right, right. At least
you're
covered for your
totally.
Minimal expenses.
Yeah, because then it's like, if you can't come, fine, I got $100. That's all right.
$100,
like, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Interesting. I think you've shared a lot of wisdom. Do you have time for, like, to see if anybody has any questions before
I've got maybe 10 minutes.
10 minutes? Yeah, that's great. Yeah. There should be. Let's see if anybody has any questions for Tad. Go ahead and do a *2 to raise your hand. And if you're on the web, go ahead and just type it in. You were really clear, and I really enjoyed it. And if you have any comments. So, Lynn. Hey, Lynn.
Hi. I have a question. Do you still have room in your beta testing for the niching spiral?
I don't. It's totally full up. Yeah, but I'll be releasing the home study in February or March.
Okay.
Yeah, so there'll be that. And it'll be better because now we're testing it and getting all the kinks out of it. So it'll be ready for you.
Okay. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you. And is that's a home study course to teach this in detail, so the exercises and whatnot to take you through it? Like you said, it could be a 6-part or a 6-hour or whatever.
It's like a... The pitch is that it's a 90-day program. So if you give 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 90 days, you'll have a workable niche by the end of it.
Mm. Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's awesome. Anybody else? Anybody else have a comment, question, anything they want to share? Anything that came up for you during this presentation that you'd like to share with the rest of us? I didn't put your hand down, Lynn. There we go. All right. Let me look on the web to see if anybody typed anything in. Beverly says, Tad, your honesty is so refreshing. Thank you so much. Thank you, Beverly. And anybody else? Going once? Twice? All right. You were clear, and I really appreciate it. And I really – because what kept ringing through, like I said earlier, was authenticity. I just don't be afraid to be who you are. In fact, be afraid to not be who you are because you don't know what you're going to get. And don't be afraid to really define those people you absolutely don't want to work with. And we've all had it. I know. You know, we've all had those people who you're going, oh, God. I had one person after I signed her up for a four-session thing, and after the first one, it was like, do I give her back a refund on the rest? Because I really wish I had just done a pay-as-you-go with this person. I would have said, hey, great, have a good life, because I didn't want to work with her. And, you know, I've learned now to be a little bit more discriminating and be able to understand when those people are going to be energy drains. And I think it's important for us to all do that and not be hungry, because we are. We're like, okay, we got to pay the rent, so we want to take this person's money or sign them up for something, and to really start to be a lot more clear and discriminating. And I'm finding that with some folks that I'm working with right now. It's like, I can be a little bit more discriminating, and I can see that maybe including some questions on an application that would give me some of the clues right up front.
Amen.
Yeah, so I think the more that we learn from speaking to people and going through those. I loved what you said about going through 10 people, that 10 people you loved working with and 10 people you didn't love working with, and really using those traits as some of the screening questions that you either do in a consultation or better in an application process, so that you can actually just get those people. I love what you said about the people that come are yes. Now, everybody in this program goes through an application process and fills in a very lengthy questionnaire, and we get to know them. And we can tell from the application if they're a good fit or not. And most people are like, once they get to the call, it's like, yeah, I want to do this. Before we even talk to them, yeah, I want to do this. It's just a question of, you know, tell me more details and how much does it cost and can I afford it? So, yeah. So thank you, really. I appreciate your time. Now tell them about the gift that you have. And there's a link on the site, and I can read it out if people need it.
Which one did I give you? The Vishing Spiral one?
Let me go back to that place. I have to click a different link to get there.
There are two things I can say for people. There's two websites. I have one is marketingforhippies.com.
Yep.
And the other is nichingspiral.com. And both of them have a bunch of free stuff. There are tabs that say free stuff on it, where you can find things. And both of them, if you sign up for the email list with Marketing for Hippies, there's a 195-page ebook. And at the Niching Spiral, there's a link for a 17-minute video that walks you through the Niching Spiral and a little workbook to kind of walk you through like a first round around the Niching Spiral.
Okay.
But there's also like a ton of, on my Marketing for Hippies website, there's hundreds of blogs. There's a lot of articles and videos and quotes and memes, and there's a Facebook group for the Niching Spiral. So there's a lot of stuff out there that's free. Yeah.
Fantastic. And the link that we have for you is drritamarie.com/go/Tad Hargrave link, gift, Tad Hargrave link, and it's H-A-R-G-R-A-V-E. So go check it out, and, you know, there's a lot of giving. I get that from you, just from the way that you work is, you know, give and make sure that there's a good fit before working together. So you can learn a lot by going out to his site, and if his workshops or his programs call to you, by all means, you know, get signed up and work with him. So thank you again for being with us. We so appreciate your authenticity, first of all, and your generosity with your time. So I'm going to open up everybody's line so that we can have people just give us a nice big round of thank you. So 1, 2, 3, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Ted. Bye-bye now.
Take care. Bye.